I arrived in Chicago in July, and the sun sparkled through the deep green trees. The boats were out of their moorings, their distant sails like the wings of doves across Lake Michigan. Marty had told me that he would be busy those first few days, and so I was left on my own. I had bought a map, and I followed Martin Luther King Drive from its northernmost to its southernmost point, then went back up Cottage Grove, down byways and alleys, past the apartment buildings and vacant lots, convenience stores and bungalow homes. And as I drove, I remembered. I remembered the whistle of the Illinois Central, bearing the weight of the thousands who had come up from the South so many years before, the black men and women and children, dirty from the soot of the rail cars, clutching their makeshift luggage, all making their way to Canaan land. The mailman I saw was Richard Wright, delivering mail before his first book sold. The little girl with the glasses and pigtails was Regina, skipping rope. I made a chain between my life and the faces I saw, borrowing other people's memories. In this way, I tried to take possession of the city, make it my own. It was during such a drive that I passed Smitty's Barbershop, a 15-by-30-foot storefront on the edge of Hyde Park, with four barber's chairs and a card table for Letitia, the part-time manicurist. The door was propped open when I walked in, the barbershop smells of hair cream and antiseptic mingling with the sound of men's laughter and the hum of slow fans. Smitty turned out to be an older black man, gray-haired, slender and stooped. His chair was open, and so I took a seat, soon joining in the familiar barbershop banter of sports and women and yesterday's headlines, conversation at once intimate and anonymous, among men who've agreed to leave their troubles outside. Somebody had just finished telling a story about his neighbor. The man had been caught in bed, with his wife's cousin, and chased at the point of a kitchen knife, buck naked, out into the street, when the talk turned to politics. "Verdoliak and the rest of them cracker aldermen don't know when to quit," the man with the newspaper said, shaking his head in disgust. "When old man Daly was mayor, didn't nobody say nothing about him putting all them Irish up in City Hall. But the minute Harold tries to hire some black people, just to even things out, they call it reverse racism. Man, that's how it always is. Whenever a black man gets into power, they're gonna try to change the rules on him. Worst part is, newspapers acting like it was black folks that started this whole mess. What you expect from the white man's paper? You right. Harold knows what he's doing, though. Just biding his time till the next election." That's how black people talked about Chicago's mayor, with a familiarity and affection normally reserved for a relative. His picture was everywhere, on the walls of shoe repair shops and beauty parlors, still glued to lampposts from the last campaign, even in the windows of the Korean dry cleaners and the Arab grocery stores, displayed prominently, like some protective totem. From the barbershop wall, that portrait looked down on me now, the handsome grizzled face, the bushy eyebrows and mustache, the twinkle in the eyes. Smitty noticed me looking at the picture and asked if I'd been in Chicago during the election. I told him I hadn't. He nodded his head. "Had to be there before Harold to understand what he means to this city," Smitty said. "Before Harold, seemed like we'd always be second-class citizens." "Plantation politics," the man with the newspaper said. "That's just what it was, too," Smitty said. "A plantation. Black people in the worst jobs, the worst housing, police brutality rampant. But when the so-called black committeemen came around election time, we'd all line up and vote the straight Democratic ticket. Sell our souls for a Christmas turkey. White folks spitting in our faces, and we'd reward them with a vote." Clumps of hair fell into my lap as I listened to the men recall Harold's rise. He had run for mayor once before, shortly after the elder Daly died, but the candidacy had faltered. A source of shame, the men told me. The lack of unity within the black community. The doubts that had to be overcome. But Harold had tried again, and this time the people were ready. They had stuck with him when the press played up the income taxes he'd failed to pay. They had rallied behind him when white Democratic committeemen, Verdoliak and others, announced their support for the Republican candidate, saying that the city would go to hell if it had a black mayor. They had turned out in record numbers on election night, ministers and gangbangers, young and old. And their faith had been rewarded. Smitty said, "That night Harold won, let me tell you, people just ran the streets. It was like the day Joe Louis knocked out Schmeling. Same feeling. People weren't just proud of Harold, they were proud of themselves. I stayed inside, but my wife and I, we couldn't go to bed until 3, we were so excited. When I woke up the next morning, seemed like the most beautiful day of my life." Smitty's voice had fallen to a whisper, and everyone in the room began to smile. From a distance, reading the newspapers back in New York, I had shared in their pride, the same sort of pride that made me root for any pro football team that fielded a black quarterback. But something was different about what I was hearing now. There was a fervor in Smitty's voice that seemed to go beyond politics. "Had to be here to understand," he had said. He'd meant here in Chicago, but he could also have meant here in my shoes, an older black man who still burns from a lifetime of insults, of foiled ambitions, of ambitions abandoned before they'd been tried. I asked myself if I could truly understand that. I assumed, took for granted, that I could. Seeing me, these men had made the same assumption. Would they feel the same way if they knew more about me? I wondered. I tried to imagine what would happen if Gramps walked into the barber shop at that moment, how the talk would stop, how the spell would be broken, the different assumptions at work. Smitty handed me the mirror to check his handiwork, then pulled off my smock and brushed off the back of my shirt. "Thanks for the history lesson," I said, standing up. "Hey, that bar's free. Haircut's $10. What's your name, anyway?"
"Barack."
"Barack, huh? You a Muslim?" "My grandfather was." He took the money and shook my hand. "Well, Barack, you should come back a little sooner next time. Your hair was looking awful raggedy when you walked in."